You have a Roman numeral 4 on your outline here, and it's removing discouragement and applying God's plan to the lives of believers. This whole last section of the book, 9, 10, 11, it is filled with practical life suggestions. Filled. I mean, really, in a sense, I could just spend a sermon on every 4 or 5 verses. So much practical daily life material of how to live in a sinful, broken world, a world that can be very unpredictable and very mean, and a world in which we don't have all the answers to the puzzles and enigmas. Solomon just gives us such great advice. And in chapter 9, and there is a mistake in your outline here. If you look at A in your outline, that says 9, 10 to 12, that should be 1 to 12. Just write out that 0. And thank Kevin and Christy for working on these outlines for you. That was really very nice of them to do that. I didn't have the nerve, but I just said, well, would you help? And they just said, give it to us, and they just took care of it. So it really, really was helpful. So don't excommunicate them from the camp. Don't. They're nice people. Okay. If you look on your outline, number 1 on the outline, Roman numeral, now number 1, the remaining mystery in this subject must not diminish human joy. Just because there are these puzzles of life, and we looked at verses 16 and 17 just very briefly. Work for the Lord, A, while it is yet day, a whole good section on being zealous for the Lord and working for the Lord. Then B, God-given wisdom is the utmost importance in our work, verses 13 to 18. And of chapter 9. And if you'll look at chapter 9, I just want to show you something here in conclusion here. Let's pick it up at verse 16. So I said, wisdom is better than strength, but the wisdom of the poor man is despised and his words are not heeded. Now that's really pretty discouraging. In the end, people don't like to listen to wisdom. Those of you who are counselors and help people, you can be out there giving people really good advice and they're shaking their head and they go out and do just the opposite. The words of the wise heard in quietness are better than the shouting of a ruler among fools. You know, the truth is, people will listen to our rulers and our newspapers and the media shouting out all their false doctrines about abortion and everything else and gambling. They'll listen to that over wisdom. Then verse 18 says, wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good. Now, you come to this real negative note, but it's, again, reality. Reality, that's what Solomon is looking at. Life under the sun, the reality of it. Not a real pretty picture. One sinner destroys much good. So basically, he's concluding this section, wisdom is important, but people really don't even listen to it. And they'd rather listen to the shouting, the foolish shouting of rulers. And the terrible thing about folly, the opposite of wisdom, is that folly can destroy so much. All right, now we come to chapter 10. Chapter 10 has one theme, and that is this, the comparison between wisdom and folly. Choose wisdom. Do not choose folly. And this chapter is just full of down-to-earth practical advice. Okay, it's a great chapter. You'll enjoy it. But to understand the chapter, verse 18 of chapter 9 is the key. One sinner destroys much good. Isn't that true? You think of one crazy man who takes a rifle and shoots Jack Kennedy. Or one insane boy who steps out of the shadow and shoots President Reagan. Nearly killed him. What a terrible thing it would have been. And crippled another man. One sinner can divide a church and ruin a church. I've seen it. As a church, I tried to help up in our Colorado area for 6 months. Right after our meetings in the morning, I'd go up there every Sunday, have dinner with a couple, trying to save this situation. Wonderful assembly. Started with a few families. Got to 150 people. They were very evangelistic. And one man came in that assembly and got them fighting. And I spent 6 months trying to help them. But they had so fought themselves down, the whole thing just finally just disintegrated. It was tragic because they had a beautiful piece of land. This would have been it was a good assembly. Things were going well. One sinner destroys much. You think of what the president has done just with his own sin here in the last 2 years, the disgrace all over the world. All over the world. And you think of his ineffectiveness. You think what he did to his wife and his daughter. my heart just breaks for them, the shame and all the people that supported him. One sinner destroys much good. Now that brings us to chapter 10, and he's going to just keep comparing. Solomon's a good teacher like his daddy, David, and he just hammers away at subjects. Doesn't mean you're losing your mind if you repeat something. Good teachers have to repeat themselves. All right, now number one, dead flies in your life. Chapter 10, verse 1. Dead flies make a perfumer's oil stink, so a little foolishness, notice that, here's the key word, a little foolishness or sin is weightier than wisdom and honor. A little foolishness is weightier than wisdom and honor. Now at Pine Bush Bible Camp one summer, the water just tasted terrible. And yes, Bill has been there, and we have egg water. It's real egg, really tastes like eggs in the water. But one summer, Bill, it was worse than that. But we had a big 20-foot tower where the water is in this huge tower, and of course it forces the water down, so we have the gravity forces the water down, so we have some water pressure. Well, a group of us got a big long ladder, and we went up there and looked in the water tower, and here was a dead squirrel. Now, you have to know, this is a real big tower and a big tank, and yet that dead squirrel. Ugh. Well, anyway, here you have a very expensive perfume. And ladies, you pull the top off, and you're going to put some of that nice perfume on, and somehow a fly got in there, and he's dead, and he has ruined the perfume. It now is spoiled. It stinks, and you don't want to put it on your neck or on your face because it doesn't smell good. Something very beautiful, very sweet, very lovely can be ruined by a little fly. And what he says is a little sin, a little folly is weightier than wisdom and honor. It can predominate over honorable wisdom. We had a neighbor, and his name was Sam Valenti. When we moved to Island, New Jersey, and Sam was really a neat guy. He was not a Christian man, but he had charm and personality. He was friendly, he was humorous, he was caring, he was a great neighbor. Now, to show you how times have changed, in the mid to late 50s, when we left the city, Newark, New Jersey, and moved to the country in Island, New Jersey, right near where the Pickets were, they were in Colonia, we were in Island, it was a lot of country then, it's all been built up today. On Sunday afternoons, when no one had fences, this was the early developments. I don't know if you had them out here, but they would build these huge, big developments, and people would move out of the city. We were now the new suburbanites. And every Sunday afternoon, our whole neighborhood had a big picnic for just whoever could make it. And I would say at least half the neighborhood made it each Sunday. And our relatives would come out of the city. To get out of the city on a Sunday afternoon, we have a big picnic, the horseshoe play and baseball. Just every Sunday afternoon was a big family gathering of the neighborhood, and we had a lot of fun. And the kids would all come. Now, no one would think of that today because everyone's so busy. So busy. They have no time for that. But we actually had a number of wonderful years like that. My cousins would come out of Newark, and we couldn't wait till they would come. And Sunday afternoon was just sheer fellowship and enjoyment. And people are missing something today in our mad, crazy, insane society where people sit behind machines all day and have buzzers going off day and night. It's really maddening. I don't think it's good for the human soul or mind or anything else. But Sam Valenti was a neighbor, and he was just a great neighbor, and he was a wonderful man. And if he had gone into real estate, he'd made millions of dollars because he had so much charm and personality. But there was a dead fly in the ointment. This wonderful man nearly twice lost his home. My dad had to bail him out twice. He lost his wife, lost his children. The dead fly was gambling. He had a serious gambling problem. Now, I didn't know it as a child. I love Sam. He's a great guy, and he just was just a kind of these, a memorable person in your life. Maybe we were just kids at the time. And later my dad told me it was gambling. He couldn't stop himself. Go down to the bookie and lay this money down. Richard Nixon, many presidential historians say Richard Nixon was possibly one of our most intelligent presidents. Certainly one of our greatest experts on foreign policy. Even after he left office, presidents would consult with him about foreign policy. He wrote a number of very important books about foreign policy. Chuck Colson said he was one of the strongest men he ever met. He had enormous strength. He said he'd never seen him sick until, of course, Watergate. And in his second election, he had a landslide victory. But there was Watergate, the fly in the ointment that destroyed his whole presidency. It could have been a great presidency, but this little fly in the ointment ruined the whole thing and turned it into one of the most ugly events in American history. And there was no reason for it. Democrats say that Ted Kennedy may be one of their greatest legislators of the past 30 years. But there's Chappaquiddick taking his car with some young girl he had no right to be with down near a bay, and she drowns, ruins his whole career. Solomon was considered one of the wisest men. He brought Israel almost to the pinnacle of its success. But there was a fly in the ointment, this love for women. And he had 700 wives and 300 concubines. It destroyed him. God told him not to do it. The Old Testament is not, it was complete disobedience. Don't ever excuse Solomon for this and say, well, that's what kings did in those days. He was a king of the people of God. And he, we are told in the book of Deuteronomy, was to have the word on the right hand and on the left hand. Isn't it interesting? God's king was to be different than any other king. He was not to multiply an army. He was not to multiply wives. His life was to be built on the word of God. On the right hand and the left hand, he was to know the word of God. He was to write it out even. And those wives ruined him, and it also ruined the kingdom. The kingdom was divided and split. He may have also had the problem of materialism, fly in the ointment. We call this the besetting sin. C.S. Lewis calls it our fatal flaw. He says everyone has at least one, some of us sorrily have several, fatal flaws. That sin that just trips you up again and again and again. Now, you know, George, I'm not struggling with alcoholism. I don't pray, Lord, help me today not to drink. But there's some believers struggle every day with alcoholism. Every day when they get up out of bed, they have to struggle with that behind, in the back of their brain somewhere, they just want that drink. You'd be shocked how many Christians I'm dealing with now, struggling with alcoholism. Talked to an older man just the other day, all his life, closet alcoholic. My mother was a closet alcoholic. People wouldn't know, but the family knew. Every day she was drunk every day. I read an article recently that 40% of Americans go to bed with too much alcohol. They're basically probably clinically drunk. 40% of Americans. You'd be surprised how many Christians you don't know about it are struggling with alcohol. It's a fatal flaw. It may trip them in some way or another. What's your fly in the ointment? We all have one, or two, or three. Identify it. Let me give you some counsel, because a little folly, that little sin, that thing that maybe you don't even take it seriously, is weightier than honor and wisdom. So you may have a lot of wisdom and a lot of honor. That little fatal fly can destroy your whole life just like that. It happens all the time. Think of one of our top evangelical leaders who's written many books in a wonderful church and then caught with a woman in a hotel. He claims this was the first time, it was an old friend, but he was very repentant and went through all the discipline. But, oh, what a stench on his life's ministry. Terrible stench on his life ministry. Never be the same. Now, thank God, this leader, unlike so many, followed a pattern of submission and of obedience and of what the elders wanted, and he is able to serve the Lord today. Many, after they're caught in sin, have all their own solutions. I believe we all have a fatal flaw. We all have a besetting sin. One of the best things to do is to seek counsel with it. Now, I'm not just talking about professional counseling. I'm talking about a close brother or sister that you're upfront about this with. And you keep account with it. I have a fellow elder. We try as hard as we can every week to get together for lunch, sometimes every 2 weeks. But he knows my besetting sins and I know his. And we sort of clobber each other on the head. Keep account of each other. It helps tremendously to talk about it to another person. Whenever you start hiding a sin, you become the victim because you become self-deluded. Pray about it every day. Whatever that fly in the ointment is, every day seek for that day fresh grace to deal with it. Don't look at it as a lifetime thing. I personally believe, as C.S. Lewis taught, that besetting sin will follow you right into the grave. You may have 10 years victory over it, but put your head down, that thing will come up like a rattlesnake and bite you. Did you know that 15% of people who are bitten by poisonous snakes, 15%, I just read this recently, are bitten, like for example out in the West, 15% of people bitten by rattlesnakes are bitten by dead rattlesnakes. Did you know that? They're dead. Now you're probably wondering how that happens. Well, they either kill them or they find them on the road, and they go up and they pick up, they want to cut the tail off or the head off, and they pick up this dead rattlesnake only to find out what? It has nervous response action, and it will turn around and bite you, although it's dead. It's like a chicken. I don't know if you've ever seen, you take a chicken, you cut its head off, it goes running all around with the blood spurt. It's the silliest thing you've ever seen. It's dead, but it's running around. Well, people kill a snake, they beat it on the head, pick it up, only to have the thing with natural recoil bite them. 15%. That's what sin's like. You think, oh, I got that under control. Only 2 years later, out of nowhere, the thing comes back like a cobra and bites you. Boy, I thought I had that under control. No, you don't. Whatever besetting sin. Now, I'm not worried right now in my life about alcoholism because I don't have any temptation towards it. Actually, most liquors, it tastes so terrible to me, I don't even know why people want to drink it. People say, let's have a whiskey. Ooh. That'd be like drinking kerosene. You say, oh, that's great. I love that kerosene. You ever see people when they drink whiskey? I was raised in a family with a lot of drinking. They go, you stole it. Why do you do that? If I drink something, I want to have a smile. But I guess that's good. I don't know. Much of drinking is simply a social thing. It really is a social thing. Well, I'm not needing to get up every day and pray, oh, Lord, save me from alcohol. I don't need to pray about gambling. I've been in Las Vegas a number of times, in Reno, because if you go out west, like with a family, you like to stop in a city like that where you can get fantastic breakfast for 99 cents and a hotel for $35. And I've walked through the casinos and that. I've never even had a temptation to put money in. Not that I think it would be wrong if I put a quarter in and tried it or anything. It wasn't even a temptation. I look at it. It's interesting to listen to all the sounds and the lights and realize they're getting. But I'm not going around like, oh, man, I'm really drawn to that. I have no temptation. Am I not great? But I have some other sins. I'm not going to tell you what they are, George. I know what you're thinking. Why don't you just tell us a few? No, no, no. Now, I pray about those every day. Every day. Even if I'm not committing them right now, I know those are my fatal flaws. Those are my weaknesses. Pray about your fatal flaw and your sin. Now, Solomon gives us real good advice. Dead flies make the perfume or oil stink. We need to realize a little sin can destroy a lot. And you can have a life of successful ministry only to destroy it in the end. Can you imagine, now, this does not seem possible now, and probably isn't because of his age, but what would have happened if Billy Graham had gone off into sexual immorality? Wouldn't that have just brought such a blight on the Lord's name? Because many unsaved actually say, well, here's someone who seems to have some integrity and some honesty. Oh, the damage would have been so severe. And it would have hurt us Christians. It would have hurt us tremendously. Say, is there anyone that can make it to the end? So what he says is a little sin, a little folly, is actually weightier than the wisdom and the honor. It's not fair. I know it's not fair, but that's the way it is. One of the statements about this book that we could make, it was actually in the seventh chapter, is that's the way it is. That's the way life is under the sun. It isn't fair. We don't even like it. But Solomon said, that's the way it is. So someone has said, Jeremy Taylor said, no grain of salt, no grain of sand is small in the mechanism of a watch. No sin is really too small that it can't destroy you. It's weightier. That's his point. It's weightier than wisdom and folly. That's the point of verse 18. One sinner destroys much good. One of our missionaries 1 year came home in a very needed rest from Spain. Spain's a very tough country. It started an assembly there. One summer they saw 25 people saved. That assembly is still going today, and his son is going back to help in that assembly in Spain, in Zaragoza. And he had come back after 4 or 5 years. He had taken his little family there. It was a great act of faith. This is right after Franco had died. Great act of faith to go to Spain with his young little family, and God used him there. And when he came back, he was back maybe 4 months, and there was a woman in the assembly that was insane. Everyone knew she was insane. Although she was insane, that woman had the assembly at its throat, and he had to fly back early and go back early to try to restore peace in that new fledgling assembly. one sinner. Even though they know, they should have known better that she had a serious mental problem, she was able to spread rumors and get them all fighting with one another, and he'd have to go back. A little sin has great weight. Now, he goes on in verse 2, number 2 in your outline. Wisdom and folly go in two different directions. A wise man's heart directs him towards the right, but the foolish man's heart directs him towards the left. Two different directions. Now notice the heart, the wise man's heart. The heart is controlled by wisdom. Remember, wisdom is something from God. The wise man's heart is ready to protect itself, to take the right action. It's the place of, the right is the place of power and of strength and success. It's the right way to do things. So wisdom will direct you to the right path. But notice what foolishness does. Foolishness in a man's heart directs him to the left. He goes to places he doesn't belong. He looks at things he shouldn't see. He talks to people he shouldn't be dealing with. Takes that drink he shouldn't be dealing with. Rather than go home right after work, he stops at the bar just for a little quick drink and goes to other places he shouldn't go. So wisdom will direct you in the right direction. Folly will direct you in the wrong direction. Now remember that, because that carries out through this whole passage, and I want to come back to this general principle. Folly and wisdom go in two different directions, the right direction and the wrong direction. The right things to do, the wrong things to do. The right places, the wrong places. Number 3 in your outline. The fool lacks common sense. Verse 3. Even when the fool walks along the road, that's just a normal common thing, nothing special about that, his sense is lacking, and he demonstrates to everyone that he's a fool. I don't know if you have this in your assembly, but we'll have at least once a week, we have people coming asking for money. Now, after many, many years of seeing this, and you've probably talked to many people like this, sometimes they even come on Sunday morning, they hit us, they know when they hit us, when you know we're busy to come in for money or something. I could actually look out in the parking lot and I can tell who's coming. I can just see the way they talk, the way they walk. They're going to come, they're going to hit us for money. After a while, you just get to know them. And one of the signs of people like this, the fool, is yak, 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 yak. Oh, they've got a thousand stories. Oh, my mother's just died down in Houston. I've got to get a bus ride. I mean, I've heard this so many times. I've got a great job here in Denver. I just need a little money to get down there for a funeral. One of our elders was at the chapel. The man came and he had a good story. His father died of cancer and needed diapers. And he says, I want you to come right down to the store with me. He's got to have diapers. So one of our elders went down to the King Super with him, bought diapers with him for his father, and bought some things for his father. And then the elder went out and sat in his car and waited. Now 10 minutes came back, and he came right back in the store, and he wanted to exchange that for cash. So the elder came, Doyle Roth, came around him, and he was just standing there watching the guy. He said, you said that was for your father. It's not for your father. It's for alcohol or drugs. You know, you can just spot them after a while, the way they walk, and particularly talk, talk, talk. In fact, I even told one person one day, why don't you just be quiet for a minute and ask for money and tell us what it's about, rather than these big, elaborate, fancy duties, stories. I mean, and even after they tell you the big story, they never stop talking. We used to have a food pantry. If they come into the food pantry, the whole time they just talk, 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 and they're trying to cover themselves and let you know everything about them. Oh, I could tell you so many crazy things. Well, here's what he says here. The fool walks, he's on the road, just a normal common thing, and you can tell he lacks sense. Just the way he walks. I remember one night we were in the evening meeting. People came in and they had a real good cock and bull story, and we found out the next day they had hit the church right down the road for money. Well, one of the elders said, you know, you have no money, but your car's running out there. Why is your car running? You have no money. I mean, save some gas. He demonstrates to everybody he's a fool. Really, they can't fool anybody. If they use a little common sense, they do a lot better, but they're fools. They don't have common sense. So the fool lacks common sense, and everyone can see it. He turns to the left, not the right. Now, number 4, how to deal with an irate supervisor. Now, all these little proverbs and these little statements have one theme. Choose wisdom over folly. That's the theme, and it's a contrast, okay? So they all connect. Don't think they don't connect. Now, in this chapter, he talks quite a bit about the area of government, and the reason for that is if there's ever an area of life where folly and wisdom are contrasted and affect more people, it's in government, it's in civil society, right? So in verse 3, if you have some fool, well, he only affects himself. But when you have fools in government, whew, everyone's affected. If the ruler's temper raises against you, do not abandon your position, because composure allays great offenses. Now, brothers and sisters, this is really a good verse for our young people. It's a wisdom principle. Wisdom principle. And in the area of government or in the area of your work, your employment, if the boss or the ruler becomes very irate with you and there's some disagreement, and notice it's against you, so you're targeted. The ruler's temper rises against you. Here's what you do. Don't abandon your position. In other words, he says, be calm. Don't respond in kind. Be cool and collective. Now, I love what he says here. Please get this. Because composure allays great offenses. Now, George, read for me what your translation says in verse 4 at the end. Composure allays great offenses.
Okay.
Verse 4. Were you getting a little nap, George?
No.
Oh, okay.
For yielding pacifies great offenses.
Okay, it pacifies great offenses, or composure allays great offenses. What a great principle here. Your boss flies off the handle at you, or in this case, a ruler who may have a lot more power could do something dangerous to you. The first thing to do is don't respond in kind, just be cool. Be collective. Be calm, because that will actually allay the whole situation. Let me read you some Proverbs. This first proverb I'm going to read you by Solomon is one that when our children were little, we made them all memorize it. There's certain verses we've had them memorize, and this is one they had to memorize because it's a great family principle, mom and dad, and some of you here have a number of small children. Proverbs 15:1. A gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. Dads and moms, remember this. And remember this with your relationship with your spouse. Your spouse gets really angry at you and really irritated and boom, lets into you. Maybe you deserve it. I don't know. Maybe it's unjust. I don't know. But I want to give you divine counsel right now. A soft answer will turn away wrath. If you start yelling and screaming back, it will escalate the whole thing. Be calm. Harsh words stir up anger. If you're an elder or a worker in assembly, and boy, people can get really angry in assembly life. I mean, I've had people just scream at me at the top of their voices. I had just in the last year a man in my face and his wife's pulling him back over nothing, nothing. In fact, I had nothing to even do with it. He somehow identified me as the culprit in his situation, which was nothing. One of our other brothers just in the last year had a lady come into his office and just, I mean, I don't know how long she screamed at him, but I could hear him down the hall screaming at her. And most of the time these things are really just some personal thing people get angry over. Well, one thing I learned, and I think I've learned this through harsh experience, don't ever answer in kind. The thing will get out of control. The best thing is to lower your voice and try to calm the situation. And that's good wisdom. It works in your marriage, and it will work with your children. Screaming and raving at your children will not help anything. You just look like a nut when you're done, or the Bible calls you a fool. This is great wisdom here we're learning. At work, at home, in the assembly. Composure allays great offenses. Now listen to what also the proverb says. Proverbs 25:15. By forbearance a ruler may be persuaded. A soft tongue breaks the bone. A soft tongue breaks the bone. Now, there's a man I've been dealing with lately, and he really can get me angry. And the reason he gets me angry is his alcoholism is hurting his family. And actually, I'd like to take him by the throat and choke him. But I know that won't help. And he's gotten on the phone with me drunk a number of times, and I really want to lash into him. But I know this man. I know if I do that, he's gone. Bye-bye. And so I have to, first of all, get a hold of myself and realize this is not about me. I don't have a right to get angry. I don't have a right to do. I've got to control the situation. So I try to lower my voice. I try to let him talk. And then I answer very softly. Well, in the process of doing this, he has drawn closer to me and he trusts me now. to let the secret out about his alcoholism. He wouldn't admit he's an alcoholic. He's come now. He knows he's an alcoholic. He knows he can't control it anymore. Well, I've only been able to draw him closer to me by not tearing him to shreds. And I do get angry at him because I know what it's doing to the family. It's hurting the family. But if I go in there right now and start swinging a club, he's gone. And there'll be one conversation and it'll be over. Because, see, the alcoholic is always hiding. So he's withdrawing. He doesn't want anyone to know. So when he gets drunk and he's lit into me, I never return in kind. I just calm the situation. And then he calms right down. He's apologizing and everything. Listen, a soft tongue breaks the bone. So when someone goes after you, you just lower your voice and you talk calmly and it will break the bones. You'll get to the issue. In elders' meetings, this is very important in elders' meetings. I don't think there's any excuse for screaming and yelling in elders' meetings or making accusations against one another. Just calm a situation and people talk reasonably. Proverbs 17:23. He who restrains his words has knowledge. He who has a cool spirit. Now, see, the Bible's cool. He who has a cool spirit is a man of understanding. You got to be careful of these passions. You know, we get some, you know, I've got, it has to be one cup. And people will divide a whole church over one cup or two cups. I've seen it. I'm not going to tell you about what I've heard about. I've seen it. I've just had it with a fellow in our church who's left the church over leavened and unleavened bread, and we've gone over and over and over this. He's left the church over leavened and unleavened bread. And I've tried to say, and I can't even get through to him, the Bible says bread, period. Why are you adding your own words to it? If you want to know, that's actually the answer to that question. The Bible has a Greek word for unleavened and bread. The Bible in both the Gospels and the Epistles says bread. So bread. So I say it's bread. We leaven or unleavened, it doesn't matter. God, and we're not Israel, and we're not the Passover. It's a new thing. But the Bible says bread, so we're safe on bread. But he is ready to leave the chapel and take his precious little family to Nowheresville, and he cannot keep a cool spirit over it. It's the end of the world here. I mean, the planets are all revolving around this. He who keeps a cool spirit is a man of understanding. This you know, my beloved brethren, but everyone must be quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to anger, for the anger of man does not achieve the righteousness of God. Proverbs 29:8, scoffers set a city aflame, but the wise man turns away anger. Proverbs 15:18, a hot-tempered man stirs up strife, but the slow to anger pacifies contention. So, here's good wisdom. Choose wisdom, don't choose folly. You're in a situation, someone's angry at you. They're irate with you. You may even be at fault. It doesn't say here. Calmness allays the great offense. In other words, the thing could get totally out of control and you start flying accusations back and forth at one another, and before long, it's so blown out of proportion. Most fights in a church or in a family are completely blown out of proportion. And then years later, everyone looks back to, what did I do? In the Denver area, there were 90 conservative Baptist churches. One man broke them and split them right down the middle. That man, years later, came to a dear friend of mine who was involved in the split and said, I made a terrible mistake. I split our whole denomination over an issue that is very secondary, thirdary issue. And it's not even clear in the Bible. Split the whole denomination in our Denver area. 50-50. One man just got passions, got out of control. Very important principle. It's the way of wisdom. It's not the way of folly. All right. Next point. Foolishness turns everything upside down. Verses 5 to 7. There is an evil I've seen under the sun like an arrow which goes forth from the ruler. Now, again, we're talking about government. Folly is set in many exalted places while rich men sit in humble places. I have seen slaves riding on horses and princes walking like slaves on the land. Wisdom and folly compared. What's the folly here? The folly here is someone in a government position setting someone in a government position who is unqualified and unfit. That's exactly what verse 6 says. Folly is set in many exalted places. You ever hear of the man Idi Amin from Uganda? Uganda is called the Pearl of Africa. He's destroyed that country. And now AIDS has destroyed it. It is one of the most devastated countries. Well, Idi Amin put in positions of government, his wives and children and people completely unfit, untrained, unprepared. We call that nepotism. And he utterly destroyed Uganda. Just a fool of fools. Can I say the same thing happens in churches? When you look at the qualifications for an elder, when you look at eldership in the New Testament, the one subject that's clear and repeated three times is qualifications. Not just anyone can be an elder in a church. You have to meet qualifications and be examined to those qualifications. I often hear people say, well, our eldership didn't work. Well, as soon as you go investigate, you realize they had totally unqualified, unfit men. Well, of course it wasn't going to work. It's like putting a man with no education over the chief general surgeon's place of the United States government. Well, you put a doctor there, a very good, trained, successful doctor, like Everett Koop. Everett Koop did a marvelous job as the Surgeon General physician. Same thing in the church. The church should be gift-based operated. You don't put a man on the platform who has no public or ability to speak. It just doesn't work. Well, what he's talking about here is the folly of putting in office unfit people, and it turns all society upside down. And so a prince who's been trained for office, he walks, well, the slave, and he's not really thinking here in terms of rich and poor. He's talking about qualified. That's what he's talking about. So don't take it out of context. The qualified man, and then the unqualified man is on the horse riding like a king, and he's not a king. He's not even fit for the place. That's folly. That's foolishness. That's turning to the left rather than to the right. Now, verses 8 to 11 are really some of the best in this chapter. Work smarter, not harder. Wisdom is the difference between success and failure. The key verse here is the end of verse 10. Wisdom has the advantage of giving success. Now, George, what does the end of verse 10 say in your translation?
Then must he put forth more strength, that wisdom is profitable to the rest.
Okay. My translation is a little more accurate here. Wisdom has the advantage of giving success. That's the key point. Let's start at verse 8. He who digs a pit may fall into it. Now, I didn't say you will fall into it. What he's talking about are the normal jobs and occupations of life, and what he says is they all have risk to them. I don't care what occupation you have. They have risk to them. If you operate on wisdom, you'll avoid a lot of hurts. If you operate on folly, you'll probably get hurt. You'll probably fall in. So let's, with that in mind, he who digs a pit may fall into it. So you're digging a well. And if you are not wise and are cautious and are guarding yourself, you may fall into the well and die. A serpent may bite him who breaks through a wall. So you're doing some reconstruction in a house. And very typical, we have this in Colorado, snakes will go into basements or into walls where it's warmer, get close to the house. I've talked to people in our own state who have pulled windows out of their home in the basement only to find, look and see a snake has gotten in there for the winter. It's very easy just for this to happen in the Near East. They'll go to houses and get in the wall and get in place that's warm. So you're working the construction on the wall, and nothing wrong with that. You're doing that, and all of a sudden a snake comes out of the wall and bites you. It's a risk. That's what he's saying. Now, wisdom says when you're digging that pit, be cautious, you may fall into it. Wisdom says, When you're pulling a window out or you're reconstructing the wall, there might be a snake in there. Look first. Don't just stick your hand into a blind hole. Oh, I just got bit. Only a dummy does that. You look in, or you put a light in, put a stick in. 9. He who quarries stones may be hurt by them. Well, if you're dealing with rocks in a quarry, you know one thing. They could fall on your head. Definitely fall on your foot. So you're cautious. And you wear shoes that have steel toes, and you wear a hard hat, and don't stand right under a tractor when it's quarrying rock. Verse 9, he who splits logs may be endangered by them. Nothing wrong with splitting logs. There's nothing wrong with what he's talking about. He's just saying it has dangers to it, has risk to it. So you're splitting logs, and you're not careful. The axe head falls off because you didn't check it, and it hits your wife in the head. Then they think you tried to kill her or something. Or you come down, you're not paying attention, you put the axe right in your toe. Cut your toe off. Verse 10. If the axe is dull and he does not sharpen its edge, then he must exert more strength. Now, verse 10 is the key right here. Wisdom has the advantage of giving success. Now, there's some really, really important lessons here. And the lesson is this, that the wise man calculates possible dangers and guards against them. That's all he's saying. Choose wisdom, don't choose folly. Wisdom is better than folly. But I like what he says in verse 10. If the axe is dull and he does not sharpen its edge, then he must exert more strength. Now let's pretend, when I was at Pine Bush Bible Camp, we did a lot of tree chopping. We're always clearing land all the time. So I've had a lot of experience with cutting trees down and clearing land. And you know, you're out there and you get a saw and you're out there with the saw and you're sawing and sawing and you say, oh, I've got 100 trees to cut today, 100 trees. And then I've got to cut them all up. I've got a busy day. And you get out there and someone says, now, you know, you ought to take 20 minutes and sharpen that saw. Oh, no, I can't. I'm just very busy. 100 trees and you're out there sawing and you're working. The person says, no, now stop. Take 20 minutes. Get a file out. We've got to go find a file. And we'll sharpen that saw. It'll be easier. Oh, no, I just can't take the time. I don't have the time. I'm so busy. So much to do today. Well, you see, that's folly. Folly says, oh, I just don't have the time to sharpen my axe and sharpen my saw. Do you know that's most of us? Do you know that? I just don't have time. I am so busy today, I don't have time for prayer and Bible study. I don't. If you knew all I had to do today and all my responsibilities, but why don't you take 10 minutes in the morning or in the evening or sometime, set 10 minutes or 20 minutes aside just to pray about the day and your labors and just open the Word of God and meet with the Lord. Oh, I know, but I'm so busy, you just don't understand. That's most of us. The cult of busyness, hypermanic society, just don't have time. Well, that's the way of folly. That's the way of folly. I want to guarantee you something. Guarantee you. If you'll take 20 minutes or a half hour out of your so-called busy day, and you give that half hour to the Lord, and just stop from your craziness, and get calm, and pray, and present the day to the Lord, and the activities of the day, and read the Word of God, you'll actually have a happier day. Did you know that? That's true. Even business people know that today. A little thing I read in a book has really been very helpful to me, and has nothing to do with Bible reading, but the same principle. If you'll take 10 minutes in the morning, 10 minutes, that's all you need, and sit at your desk, learn to control the phone. Get a phone answering machine. It's a great miracle thing. Get a phone answering, and you actually don't have to answer the phone every time it rings. You really don't. I know you're all so guilty. Who is it? You know? I always tell people, I can't raise the dead. So if someone has died, I will help, but I can't raise the dead. So I can wait 5 more minutes. You don't have to answer the phone every time it rings. If you will take 10 minutes and look over the whole day, what you're supposed to do, what you're not supposed to do, where you're supposed to say no, little time for exercise, time for your lunch, do the first jobs first, the important jobs that you got to get out of the way. If you'll take 10 minutes and plan your day, you'll have a much more successful day. Now, you can look at Covey's material, 7 Reasons to Success, or all that. It's all the same material. They call it sharpening the saws, right here in Ecclesiastes. Take a little time to sharpen yourself before you start the day's activity. Wisdom has the advantage of success. That's his whole point here. Life has risks. Life has problems. Spend a little time and sharpen your saw, and you'll have more success. That's all he's saying. You know, some of you don't ever take a day off. You need a day off. Now, I know we're not under Sabbath. That's very clear from Colossians. We're not under Sabbath. But there's the principle of rest. You got to rest every day. I don't know if you remember this or know this, but just weeks ago there was an article, full page, full lead article about why teenagers need rest, biologically, hormonally. And teenagers are not getting enough rest today. They've got all the band, they've got sports, they've got school, they've got lots of homework. And we've set up a society where the young person actually does not rest like their physical, biological nature needs because of changes. And it will actually hurt them later in life. It will hurt them. You need to sleep. You need to rest. God built that into the system. You can't work 7 days a week right around the clock. You can't. You will break down after a while. Strange things will happen to you. Maybe some of those dead flies will get a hold of you. You need a day of rest. You do need rest. You need a cycle to your week. Some of you need a vacation. You haven't taken a vacation. You need a vacation. You need a time off. It's sharpening the saw. You need a time to think and to rest and to reflect on what you're doing. some of us are on a treadmill experience. We're just go, go, go. If we stop the treadmill, we just feel like, well, of course, everything's going to halt. Wisdom has the advantage of success. Now, verse 11, if the serpent bites before being charmed, there's no profit for the charmer. I don't know whether God has erased my mind or something, but I have no conception of time at this camp. I have no idea. Normally, I'm a time-oriented person. Either that or I'm resting too much. I have no idea when I'm supposed to stop. I don't know when I started. The strangest thing really is strange. Most places you go, they're real neurotic about time, and I try to follow those rules. I don't know when I start, I don't know when I'm supposed to end, so blabbering on here. I don't know. If the serpent bites before being charmed, there's no profit for the charmer. What he's saying here is prevent disaster, don't procrastinate. Now, I have a story to tell you. This is a true story. A lady in our assembly from India, she's a Parsi, was saved through Brother Bhakti Singh's ministry, and they had a cobra in the backyard. They knew it was there. They'd seen it go into this pipe and that. And they should have called the snake handler or the snake charmer. It's called snake charmer here, or the snake catcher, actually what it is, to get that thing out of the backyard. Well, they didn't do that. And on one of the family parties, a large family party, maybe 50, 60 people there, one of the little children saw the snake's head come out, and he went and put his hand in the hole and was bitten and died at the party. That was the fault of the family. They knew that snake was, they'd seen it, and they were going to do something about it. They didn't do anything about it. And that's exactly what he's saying here. And this is the way of wisdom. The wisdom says there's danger out there. Let's deal with it right away and get rid of it. Someone's going to get hurt. There's a hole in the backyard. My dad was in Las Vegas. He was not a Christian at the time. He was in Las Vegas, and they had this ramp coming down and pools on both sides. Well, the ramp gets crowded with people sometimes. I can't believe they got away the inspection code. Didn't allow this. When he's coming down the ramp and just stepped aside because people were coming and fell backward into a fountain. He was lucky he wasn't killed, but he broke some ribs and he was in a lot of pain for a long time. And of course, he had a classic case for a lawsuit. Except that my father hates lawyers so much he wouldn't get a lawyer and try to do it himself and wound up with almost nothing. But he could have had a lawsuit. The point is, there should have been a rail on a busy ramp. Someone was going to fall into that fountain, and he fell into that fountain. You prepare for things and don't procrastinate. That's the point. Don't procrastination is a terrible thing. It frustrates everybody. If you're an elder in a church, don't be a procrastinator. It drives people crazy. I've heard this complaint just the last couple of weeks. Someone called the eldership the sinkhole. You tell them something or ask for something, it might be 8 months before you hear from them again. Just like, don't even bother them. You know, that's terrible, terrible. If someone asks you something, you get right back to them. Set a date when you're going to get back to them or what the issue is. If the snake bites before being charmed, there's no profit in the charmer. He's not going to help you after you've been bitten. So if you're going to have an accident, deal with it now. If you see an accident, you got bald tires in those front car of your car, and you send your kids out in it and they have an accident, it's your fault. Get some tires on the front of that car. All right. Now, in verses 12 to 15, foolish and wise use of the tongue. Nothing more important than the tongue. The tongue is certainly the most talked about and addressed issue in the Proverbs. If there's any place that wisdom and folly shine, it's in this. I'll move a little quicker now. Words from the mouth of the wise man are gracious, while the lips of a fool consume him. I had a bunch of Proverbs to read, but I won't read them to you. You know the Proverbs are filled with the blessing of a wise tongue. The words of the mouth of a wise man, they're gracious. They heal, they pacify, they encourage. While the lips of a fool consume. In other words, he hurts himself. It's just silly talk. The beginning of his talk is folly, silliness, but the end of it is wicked madness, insanity. So it starts out just silly and foolish, but it ends up insanity and very, very hurtful. That's not the way of wisdom. Verse 14. Yet the fool multiplies words, and the proverb says the more you multiply words, the more the chances are of sinning. No man knows what will happen, and who can tell him what will come after him? The toil of a fool so wearies him that he does not even know how to go to a city. Well, a city is something big and obvious and open. Well, all he does is rattle on and on. He just talks about what he doesn't know, what he's talking about. He can't even find his way to the city. We say in our language, you can't find your way home. So the fool just senselessly talks and rattles on, and he can't even do obvious important things. Now, verses 16 to 20, the fool, wise and foolish king, and he comes back to this whole issue again of government. because, again, government is a place that really shows wisdom and folly, and a place that affects everybody. Woe to the land whose king is a lad. He's immature, he's unqualified, he's untested. Woe to the land whose king is a lad. He's not fit for office. Nothing wrong with being a lad, it's just that he's not in the right place. And whose princes feast in the morning. In other words, they're irresponsible and self-indulgent. People normally don't start eating big meals in the morning and drink in the morning. People who do that are really fools. Well, imagine if you're rulers, that's the first thing they get up in the morning. Let's go have a big feast. That's what you do in the evening when your day's work is done. In other words, they're irresponsible and self-indulgent. They're immature. Woe to the land. Woe to the land. You got fools. And you look around the world, you see a lot of countries where fools are running the country. Whew! Poor people. Now, blessed are you, O land, whose king is of nobility and whose princes eat at the appropriate time for strength and not for drunkenness. In other words, you've got qualified leaders and they have responsible lives. They eat at the proper time. They eat for strength. They're not just saying, hey, let's just get loaded, you know? Let's get plastered. Oh, we feel so great when we're plastered. We make better decisions when we're plastered. Three martinis and I can decide on anything. Now their laziness. Through indolence, the rafters sag. Through slackness, the house leaks. In other words, they're also lazy, irresponsible rulers, and they just sort of let society fall apart. Boy, a lot of rulers like that. Just everything's, the roads are falling apart, bridges are falling apart, people aren't being paid. Men prepare a meal for enjoyment. Wine makes life merry, and money is the answer to everything. In other words, these are selfish rulers who think, hey, just throw some money at it and we'll answer all the problems. So his point is, if you have foolish rulers, woe to the land. If you have wise rulers, you're blessed. And that's true today. Be careful who you elect into office. I can't believe we had an experienced, well-seasoned president, and we got rid of him for an upstart. Cannot believe it, but you reap what you sow. Verse 20, furthermore, in your bedchamber do not curse a king, this is wisdom, and in your sleeping rooms do not curse a rich man, for a bird of the heavens will carry the sound and the winged creatures will make the matter known. In other words, walls have ears. And this is wisdom again in government, and he's saying be careful when you talk against the king. And you talk against a ruler because if you've got any brains at all, you know it'll get back to that person. Unless he's an upstart. And then, of course, who knows what he'll do then. So what he's saying, wisdom tells you, guard your tongue. And when you say something, expect that it will get back to the person. You've learned that maybe, hopefully, through the years of life. Can I just conclude with this? We all have flies in the ointment. And we've all turned too many times to the left and not to the right. There's only one who is not. Only the Lord Jesus Christ had no flies in the ointment. He never turned to the left. He always turned to the right. He is the man of wisdom. God could look down at him and say, he's my son. He always does the things that please me. No other human can say that. In fact, when we're honest with ourselves, our own folly shocks us. How could I have been so stupid? Sometimes we seem to major in stupidity. Only the Son of God was the perfect man of wisdom. The man that Solomon idolizes, the picture we're to go towards. And that's why he can forgive us of the dead flies. He can forgive us of our turning left and not turning right. He came to do that because flies destroy all our lives. And turning to the left and acting like fools and not like wise men have hurt all of us. But he offers forgiveness and the great thing about Christianity, power over sin. So he is the ideal wise man. Let's pray. Lord, we thank you that we do have a real example of the wise man, the perfect man, the one who always does the Father's will, who chooses the path of wisdom, who always has the perfect right response to every situation, the right disposition, the right perfect words. We think of how often we have failed in our words, in our attitudes, in our responses. We thank you there's forgiveness and there's hope and there's power. But it's all because of Christ. in his name. Amen.